You're listening to a podcast from 702.
This hour, we tackle an enormously difficult issue, which is justice or lack thereof for victims and survivors of various forms of sexual violence, including rape. And one of the ways in which activism is attempting to speak back against the monstrosity of the incredible levels of gender violence that we are seeing and experiencing in South Africa is through public naming and shaming. And one conversation we need to have is, what does the law have to say about that? Can I go on Twitter right now and name my abuser? What will be the consequences legally if I do so? A little bit later, I want to expand the conversation with Professor Bonita Meyersfeldt and ask, if we accept that there are certain limitations when it comes to the existing criminal justice system not serving girls and women as effectively as the system ought to, how do we achieve justice in an imperfect judicial ecosystem? But that's coming up later. But in the first instance, I want to understand, what happens if I were to go on Twitter right now and name someone? And I am delighted to say that for the first 30 minutes of this conversation, I'm joined by Otrebia Ampofu Anti, who is a media law specialist and a partner at Ampofu Anti Consulting. She is super clever, enormously vested in questions of justice. And really, we should have her on the show and in the media far more often than we do in between her own hustle. Otrebia, good morning, and thank you for coming on my show.
Good morning, CBS. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure. It's all ours. And thank you for sharing your brain power with us. Let's jump straight into it. If I go on Twitter right now and I name someone as the person that raped me, what does the law have to say about me doing so?
So I think the first point that I always like to emphasize is that the law online is the same as the law in the real world. Mm. And I like to make that point because I think sometimes we don't always understand that. So we shouldn't always think of these things as totally separate. Mm. If you wouldn't sort of put up a billboard on a topic, then putting it up on social media, it's the same thing. So that's the one point. The second thing, to answer your question more directly, is that the law of defamation would apply. And what the law of defamation basically says is that if you put out a statement about somebody which would result in other people thinking less of that person, in other words, their reputation being harmed by that statement, then you are potentially liable in terms of a defamation claim. And so if you go on Twitter and say, so-and-so assaulted me, obviously people will think less of that person, their reputation will be harmed, and therefore there's a potential defamation claim that you are exposing yourself to.
If, as the survivor, it is my genuinely expressed memory of my truth of what I experienced, does that cover me legally?
So when it comes to a defamation claim, there are a number of different defenses that are applicable. The two that I want to mention here, which I think are most relevant for this type of thing, are truth and public interest and fair comment. Truth and public interest, as you know, the name of the defense implies, means that you can prove that what you said is the truth and that it is in the public interest. I think it goes without saying that if we're talking about issues of sexual assault, it is obviously in the public interest for a perpetrator to be named because there could be a danger to society more broadly. The trickier question becomes, is it the truth? And, you know, this is where it really becomes very challenging to prove what is true and what is not in a court of law as compared to the court of public opinion. And I'm glad you said you're going to be speaking to Professor Bonita Meyersfeldt later, because she has some very interesting thoughts on how the courts go about assessing evidence in cases of sexual offenses and how prejudicial it can be to the survivor. But I think what we need to bear in mind is that even if you are the survivor, the fact that this is what you feel you experienced, it's not unfortunately guaranteed that you will be able to prove in a court that that is in fact what happened, which is what you would have to be able to do in order to escape a claim of defamation against you. Then the second point I mentioned
about fair comment.
And I think that one is a little bit more flexible because, again, the underlying facts should be true, but you are able to then comment on those facts. And I think this is where one would need to be more, potentially more creative in the way that you speak online to say, this was my experience of a particular event, and this is my opinion about what I believe has happened to me. Where you are saying to people, this is how it played itself out, and to my mind, this is what it means. And let the person come and say, it didn't happen that way, or it did happen that way, but I didn't think I was raping you. For example, the unfortunate incidents we hear where someone has maybe had a lot of alcohol, and they get into a situation where they're not able to consent, but the man insists that they are able to consent. And then he says, well, I didn't rape you, you were consenting. And she says, you did rape me because I was drunk and I couldn't have been consenting. And it becomes a he said, she said as to how the incident plays itself out. In those kinds of incidents, couching it as this is what happened and this is my opinion of what he did is better than simply saying, well, you just raped me.
Can I get in trouble as a third party for retweeting? If I believe you and I'm retweeting as a matter of solidarity, can I also be potentially subject to legal action?
Absolutely. Yes, you can be. Because in our defamation law, we have what we call a repetition rule, which means that if you repeat a defamatory statement, then you are equally liable. And this is the reason why, historically, for example, newspapers were liable for publishing statements made by other people, where someone comes out and says, Otrebia did 1, 2, 3, and, you know, Eusebius allows me to repeat that on the radio or writes it in one of his columns, then he's equally liable. And it's exactly the same thing with a retweet. Even if you put what has now become a common thing, retweet is not an endorsement. it does not necessarily protect you from a legal point of view. And I think that's where, especially if you are someone who would be considered, for example, an influencer, then you really need to be careful about what you retweet because you may have an audience of 1 million people. You know, if Eusebius tweets something, retweets something, it means something because you have the weight of your journalistic integrity behind you, and your retweet suggests that there's veracity or weight that must be given to what the person has said in their tweet. So you are going to be liable. And from a risk management point of view, if you are on Twitter, and especially if you're influential, you need to realize that people are going to come after you.
Yes.
They may not come after me because I might be a nobody.
Sure.
But if you're a somebody and you retweet me, then they're going to come after you because you're the one that's going to make it go viral.
I hear you. That makes sense. What about the subtle variation on retweeting? Can I, as a journalist, report on an allegation? Can I go on my show tomorrow and say, I'm not saying it is true, but yesterday so-and-so alleged that this media personality had sexually attacked them, and I'm simply describing factually what I saw on my Twitter timeline. Can I do that kind of thing?
Yes, I think that's a much more wise way of dealing with a sort of retweet or a reportage, because then what you are actually saying is you're not saying this happened. You're saying this person is making this allegation against this other person, and it is newsworthy and in the public interest that this dispute be aired out. And then there's room, especially if you're a member of the media, then there's room for the defense of reasonable publication, which basically protects the media for bringing to light matters that are in the public interest where it's reasonable to do so. Of course, there's still a little bit of due diligence that needs to be done around it. And I think, again, this is one of my bugbears, is that because we are now living in the information age, people think that any piece of information that they see online, which they think is interesting or important, can simply be repeated without even taking 10 minutes to go and look into that matter and see whether it's being refuted, whether it is obviously fake, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of work has to be done, especially if you are someone who is influential and has a platform.
Okay, no, that makes complete sense. I want to come back to the norm or fair comment. Let's say I've got a story to tell for why, despite the standards of evidence that I'll ask Bonnie about later, why I, as a matter of social reality, believe a woman, even if criminal law standards differ. So take an international example. I believe the women that say that they had been drugged and raped by Bill Cosby. I believe that as Eusebius McKaiser sincerely, regardless of whether or not he gets acquitted on any of those claims. And I can tell a story why the odds of so many women who do not know each other across time and place risking inviting the trolling that comes with publicly outing yourself as a survivor, inviting the complete and utter toxicity of super fans of a larger than life comic and actor and person in Bill Cosby, etc., etc., etc. I can tell a story why my own understanding in terms of a more socially acceptable epistemology means that I must, if I'm serious about how the odds are stacked up against you to say that you were raped and how unlikely statistically it is for most rape claims to be false, why I believe the women that say Bill Cosby did this to us. In the South African context, can I take a similar kind of view as a commentator, or would you caution me to wait for the law to first make a judgment call? And I'm asking that because I'm wary, which is exactly where I want to expand the conversation with Professor Benita Meyersfeld, but you can jump in here already, or Trebe, because I know that you think about these things. I'm wary of using the law as the beginning and the end for trying to make sense of truth.
No, for sure. I think that this is sort of legal theory 101,
yeah.
The distinction between the law and justice, right? And it's an unfortunate distinction because they should, in my view at least, be the same thing.
Yes.
But they're not. Not as our legal system is currently structured, and certainly not as our social and power dynamics are currently structured.
Mm-hmm.
So to your example, I think that it is a difficult example for me to be able to say to you, yes, go ahead and write that without any legal consequences, because the bottom line is that even when you are posting something in terms of, say, comment, the requirements are that you must be stating an opinion. In other words, you must be asserting a fact. You must be asserting an opinion. And then secondly, the facts on which you are basing your opinion must be true or substantially true. Or generally well known. Thirdly, that it must be in the public interest. So in your example of a Bill Cosby, sticking to that example, it would obviously be the case that you would be stating an opinion, you would be stating it would be in the public interest. But when it comes to the facts, then the question still remains of whether what these women said happened is actually what happened or not. Because if it didn't happen, then the facts on which you are basing your commentary is not true, and then you are in a difficult position with respect to the defense of their comments. So I think that would be the legal analysis, that our law as it currently stands would not be 100% clear that you can write an opinion of that nature, especially when you are not the person who actually experienced it. I think if you are a person who actually experienced something, it becomes quite a different matter, because you can say, this is what happened to me. This is the actual facts of what happened. And therefore, this is my view of how I take this. This is what I interpret this incident to me.
I hear you, Jan. That is such a beautiful point. But this complicated relationship that is not a linear and a clear one between law, justice, and I would say activism really, really, really fascinates me. Because for me, one of the things that rape survivors often do not get from the person that they tell their story to is to be believed. And one of the most important parts of the healing process very often is simply for your story to be believed. And when we understand from a social point of view how the odds are stacked against you, such that you have more rational reason to never speak your truth than to make a rape claim, then I think the case for believing someone increases. And so, for example, in my last book, I didn't just give the opinion that I believe the woman in the Bill Cosby example. I would assert it as factually true that they had experienced what they had said, right? And that's on the basis of being able to tell a story from an evidence point of view, why I think that in terms of probabilistic reasoning, what they are saying is just about to be considered to be truthfully what they had experienced. So I want to ask you this question. Stepping back from the detail of what you've helped us to understand, what do you make, as a woman, as a lawyer, as a media law specialist, of how this is playing out in South Africa on Twitter as a form of political activism?
I think it's a really difficult one because I think, you know, as you say, I'm wearing a lot of different hats.
Yes.
My hat as a woman says absolutely these people must be named and shamed because there's no other, it seems like or feels like there's no other way to get accountability.
Yes.
But my hat as a lawyer says, whoa, you know, there's also such a thing as fairness and process. And not everything, with the sad reality is that in as much as most of these people that are being named have a case to answer, there's always that incident where it's either subject to interpretation or someone is being unfairly accused. And the whole point of law and the procedures that have been developed around it is to create a structured situation where everyone has an opportunity to prove or disprove the accusation. And what happens when you go on Twitter and say this is what happened is that the perpetrator is then completely being robbed of the opportunity to actually prove that they didn't do what they're being accused of. So as a lawyer, I would say that there's always two sides to each and every single story. And I think it troubles me to have to say it because, as I said, as a woman, you always feel like, of course, speak your truth.
Yeah.
But as a lawyer, one of the things we see when we actually work with cases is the fact that there are always two sides to every single story. Just this past week, I had someone who I know on a personal level getting in touch with me and saying, there's someone who I have never met before who's sitting overseas, who has gone online on YouTube and on other platforms like Twitter and is making an allegation that I am in possession of nude photos of her and were spreading them online and so on and so forth and basically trolling him. But he has never even laid eyes on this woman and she lives overseas. And it seems like if you actually go into the commentary on her YouTube and so forth, you see other people popping up and saying, she did this to me and she did this to me and I got her account closed down and here she is again.
Yeah.
So she seems to be someone who, for whatever reasons, wants to sort of go out there and do this. Obviously, that's the exceptional case, right?
For sure, yeah.
But it exists. And that's why systems and processes are important. And so I think that we are in a moment in South Africa where, unfortunately, our legal system is really letting us down in terms of justice in a structured environment. And as a result of that, we have to take it to the streets. We have to take it to Twitter and seek justice in an unstructured environment. And I think that the tension between these things shouldn't automatically be resolved by saying, oh, that's illegal, and so don't do it.
Yeah.
Because that's then shutting down the space for any form of activism, any form of accountability when the system that is supposed to be structured is broken. So I think we need to use all of these platforms. We can't allow ourselves to be silenced. And I think that the law needs to catch up to where we are. The law needs to catch up to the fact that until such time as the justice system is fixed, these types of things are going to keep on happening.
Well, and that's exactly where I wanted to go with my last question, because I wondered, right, when you wear your hat as a lawyer, then you look at sources of law as they currently stand. But if you were part of the South African Law Reform Commission, I wonder if you were to be invited by the government to rethink Criminal Procedure Acts of 1977 and other sources of legislation that guide evidence, whether you'd be prepared to do so. Because there are two scenarios that strike me as equally undesirable in the law. The one is the status quo, and the other extreme is, although some people make a case for it, is a presumption of guilt. But in between, are there aspects of criminal law in particular, and maybe even civil law, that can be reformed? So I'm thinking, for example, what is consent? Did you get an enthusiastic yes, as opposed to asking, did you get an explicit no? What does the law have to say about that, for example? So you're shifting the burden to someone to prove that they got enthusiastic consent, and we can work out in legalese what that might mean in a new set of laws, as opposed to the current status quo, where it's not clear to me what consent means in law. But if you are, you know, a peddler of toxic masculinity, you will necessarily want to read the threshold requirement as low as possible and say, unless she says explicitly no, then I'm going to take it to mean that there actually was consent. So in the 2 minutes that are left, without giving me a definitive view, what might be areas of the law that do not require us to throw out of the window things like hear the other side or introducing a presumption of guilt, but that moves us from accepting the current legal framework as axiomatic?
Look, I actually think that I wouldn't even want to start with the substantive law, because I think that that's not all, just where the problem sits.
Sure.
I think that the biggest part of the problem actually sits with the system and the process around the criminal justice system. I think that if we had a truly victim-centric approach to sexual offense matters, and in fact all criminal matters, where the focus is not on the state and the state trying to get justice and the state having its objective, but the person who has been subjected to a crime being at the center, being allowed to lead and influence the prosecution of their own matter, which is not something that you get at the moment. If you've ever been in contact with the criminal justice system, you know that you become a passenger in your own car, basically, and you have a driver who does not want to know where you are going. They just drive, and you arrive at the destination that they choose. So I think that's the one thing that we need to change. The second thing I think we need to change is the efficiency of the system. If we could fix the speed with which these prosecutions happen and the efficiency with which they take place, so that within a few months you could see a matter being run from beginning to end and a judgment is rendered, if you could, without constant delays and postponements, if we could see a situation where the backlog in our units that have to deal with forensic evidence can be cleared so that rape kits can actually be assessed and trials can run, etc. I think that that would really change things a lot before we even start going to questions of whether there was consent or not. Because let's face it, right? In South Africa, the epidemic of sexual assault is so bad that I actually think it's the rare case where you are dealing with, oh, it wasn't clear whether she said yes or no. Quite frankly, I think that the epidemic of rape in South Africa is so bad that it's quite clear that people are saying no. So I wouldn't even position it there. The problem is that survivors are getting completely frustrated to the point where they don't want to even go and report these matters and initiate cases.
That's right.
Because they have an understanding of the fact that they will not be centered in the process and that there will be a miscarriage of justice. So I would go for the processes and the procedures and the structures around our criminal justice system to actually deliver justice. Then people wouldn't feel the need to go to Twitter, because they know that I just need to go to the police station, lay a charge, and he will be dealt with there.
Absolutely brilliant. Love your brain, love your work and your commitment to justice, not just the law. Otrebia, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
That was Otrebia Ampofu Anti, and Otrebia is a media law specialist and a partner at Ampofu Anti Consulting.